And now,
11 LRNI. Now the lights dim low. Soon we'll start the show. Here comes LF Midwood.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you could tell that was the official video. I grabbed it off. I was just I played it off of YouTube. You could tell it's the official video because it's got the live audience background lead in and all that. So welcome to the Midwood Files. My name is Alice Midwood. You know, I was talking to JL earlier this evening, and I asked him if he was gonna go see the final tour of Dead and Company, and he indicated no. the cost, and I believe the last couple of shows he's gone to, he's been annoyed by people who were talking during the instrumentals. So, I don't blame him. I think my policy's pretty much been the same, and I don't listen to anything that's post 95, meaning the actual Grateful Dead. I saw them on their last tour as they came through New York at Meadowlands. I've told that story before. And I'm happy. I'm a happy camper. I have not run out of stuff to listen to. There are so many shows available and more stuff's being put out that I'm able to get access through my music services on a regular. I think that Madison Square Garden set was just released. I think that's a 3-disc set. I haven't really delved into that too much. Bobby's birthday was, I think, last week, and I think Brett Midland's birthday was, I think, yesterday. Brett Midland, my third favorite keyboardist, maybe even fourth if you count Tom Constantino. Yeah, probably fourth. Probably fourth, now that I think about it. But, so I opened with a track from friggin' In the Dark, and I'll close with a Midland track from In the Dark, Hell in a Bucket. I really enjoy that track. It's just kind of interesting. I know I've been following, you know, more than a few of the Grateful Dead groups for a while now, and I find it interesting with what people are upset and complaining about over various courses of any given day. But the ticket costs, I think, for the close, for this last tour that's supposed to be the last tour anyway, summer 2023. I think the biggest thing that, like, within the last couple of days that I heard is people are upset because they added a couple of shows, and I think one of them was in San Francisco. So I think people who had hoped to get the last, be able to see the last show of Dead & Co. Won't. They bought their tickets thinking they would, and now they won't, because there's been a show slapped on the end there. So, you know, that can kind of suck. And you know, if you think about it, you know, Dead & Co. they're basically a Dead cover band. there's really no other way to put it. They're a Grateful Dead cover band. I never really got the other fascination. I guess there's a whole generation of people who have been able to experience and enjoy the music. Whether it be Phil Lesh and Friends or Dead & Co. Or the other ones, I guess, or the Dead. I think they toured as the Dead for a little while there. So I kind of get that. You know, kind of makes me feel old. Not for nothing. You know, there's a whole generation out there that never got to see Jerry play. You know, never see a show with Jerry. So, I mean, I couldn't fathom that. That to me is like, oh, that's insane. I guess you make do with what you have, right? You know, and the thing, I don't want to hear Bobby doing Jerry songs. I don't want to hear Bobby doing Jerry songs. I don't want to hear Bobby playing at like quarter speed. You got to speed it up a little bit. You know, if you actually take some of these recordings and you speed them up, they wind up being, I think they wind up being at the correct speed. I don't know why, what the deal is with Bobby needing to do that. Maybe it's easier for him to remember the words that way. I don't know. I can't say. I know people who have gone to see Dead & Co. and are very pleased, and that's great. And I know, you know, people have gone to see Phil and Friends. And I think the Phil and Friends thing might be closer to what Dead would have evolved into, or, you know, maybe gone in that direction. One, it's obviously new music, which is good. And I think, like I said, I think the one track that I played, Night of a Thousand Stars, that could be very easily have been a Dead song. Very easily have been a Grateful Dead song, but obviously wasn't. So, you know, best of luck to all yous trying to get the tickets out there, and congratulations to those who have seen before they disappeared. I don't know what these guys are going to be doing. They're getting old. They're certainly not going to be going on for another 20 years for sure. Like I said, there's always the recordings. I think archive.com's got tons of shit too. Not for nothing. And bouncing around on YouTube, there's plenty of places to find good live Grateful Dead music that you've probably never heard before. So, I mean, if I picked a show a day for the rest of my life, I'd probably never run out. So, you know, never have to repeat. Now, some shows you want to repeat because they're that good. But not necessarily all of them. That being said, I think I did the regular show opening. There's not much going on a personal level this week. My health is maintaining. I've not been terribly ill as of late, which is good. I got a bunch of tests scheduled for the first week of November. So we'll have to see what comes of that. But I haven't been sick, and what am I in? I'm in day 23, no weed. Got like another week to go. I was thinking Halloween, but we'll see. I may wait to after the test because maybe I don't want to, you know, take a chance of not skewing something. I'm not really sure. I'll have to give it some serious thought. But unless I get sick sometime in the next 7 days, I would say I don't know how much the weed has to do with it, because I was smoking pretty much like a chimney in September, and I didn't have any problems. And I stopped smoking for October, and I didn't have any problems. So I'm not quite sure exactly what we've determined based upon those data points. I don't know. I have to think of me if I burp a little bit. I had a little Chinese food for dinner. And I got some news. I got regular news. I mean, I don't have any personal news. No news is good news, as they say. You know, I got to do something. I don't know. What the hell is going on with this? Got to take these off for a second. Put these over here. Excellent. I guess, all right, it's fine. I have a tendency to look at my pop filter on this mic from above. And from above, it looks like it's, what the hell is that? All right, jeez. I got to clean this thing. Oh, God. Yeah, I got to wipe that down. It's the silvery, blingy, robot, phallic microphone. It's the only one I use. It's starting to look a little, the screen's starting to look a little yucky. I don't know. All right, anyway. This is stuff, you know, there's tons of stuff that I should do before the program that I don't. I just don't. I figure, hey, let me do it during the show. What do we got? DOJ, this, that, the other. Oh, let's start with the bugs thing. I thought this was kind of interesting. Because I was watching, I've been watching the Iron Chef Americas, because I never got a chance to finish those. So I've been watching them on Discovery. I guess Discovery does the Cooking Channel stuff, or has a fair amount of Cooking Channel stuff up there. And I have to get back into cooking. The sauce experiment went pretty well after all that time. So apparently I can still, there's still the brain still works. I'm just not as fast as I used to be. But yeah, I want to start cooking again. But we were watching an episode of Iron Chef America, and there was one of the challenges had prepared something with some grasshoppers, like little grasshoppers on top of it, like actual real grasshoppers. And apparently, look online, you can purchase grasshoppers by the like bag full, like chips, like they sell them like chips in certain countries, like different flavors and whatnot, which is really kind of. And it's, you know, I've known about it for like a long time, because there's like such a high level of protein involved with those little critters. And like my understanding is that they don't taste like grasshoppers. Not that I know what a grasshopper would actually taste like, but they just taste like crunchy. It's more about a crunch. But still, you kind of cringe at the thought. But I've got an article here out of everydayhealth.com. And this is dated October 11th, so it's not that long ago. Bugs may be the best protein source you've never eaten. Our resident registered dietitian nutritionist gives insects a try and even offers a creepy crawly dessert recipe. Oh, interesting. Okay, so here we go. What if I told you, and this is, who wrote this? I like to give credit. Kelly Kennedy, for a diet, is it for everyday dietitian. Medically reviewed by Lynn and Greiger, R registered DNs, RNDC, CDES, ABCDFG. Here we go. What if I told you that there was an excellent source of protein that 1/4 of the world's population eats on a regular basis? It's according to the New York Times, by the way. So you got to take that with a grain of grasshopper. Anyway. But you've probably never tried. It's even been called the protein of the future. Oh, and it's a sustainable choice, too. Sounds exciting, right? That's something you never get your hands on. Now, what if I told you that the amazing protein source was bugs? Does that change your opinion and willingness to add them to your diet? The practice of eating insects, called entomophagy, may sound strange to those of us in Western cultures, but it's common in other parts of the world. Many cultures even consider bugs a delicacy. In some parts of Africa, almost 50% of the residents' dietary protein comes from bugs, notes an article from Nutrition Bulletin. And just as a side note, I used to watch, I don't know if he still does it, but there was I can't think of the dude who was on the Food Channel, Zimmerman. I believe he did bugs more than a few times in the Strange and Unusual Foods things. I hear that they fry tarantulas in certain Eastern countries, and that they actually they taste like crab. You know, the legs and whatnot taste like crab. So I don't know. I don't know. Where, you know, I don't eat seafood because I consider them to be the bugs of the ocean. I really do. But I just always thought that was kind of interesting. Fried tarantulas, deep fried. Yeah. Given eating bugs is not part of a culture where I grew up in the United States, I never really considered adding bugs to my diet in the past. But the more I read about the benefits of this protein source, the more creative and delicious sounding ways I see bugs being consumed, the more I think about insects not only as a potential addition to my plate, but an important part of a healthy and sustainable diet. Let me tell you more about what I mean. Eating bugs is good for your health. As mentioned, bugs are excellent sources of protein, with nutrients accounting between 20 and 76% of their dry weight, according to a study published in Science Direct. By comparison, 90% of ground beef is 20% protein by weight, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's not at all a study. What is it? That's not at all a study published in January 21. In critical reviews in Food and Science Nutrition, found that bugs are also a good source of many vitamins and minerals, including several that are commonly deficient in American diets, including B12, iron, zinc, fiber, omega-3, fatty acids. At the same time, bugs are low and or free of, depending upon the species and preparation method, nutrients that is generally recommended to the limit, including unhealthy fats, sugars, and sodium. Hang on, I don't want to grab my, I have another bottle of tea. I've been drinking a lot lately. Yeah, I still have to get the do 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 do. Okay. Back to said article. One of the main criticisms of eating bugs has been its disastrous environmental impact. A study published in September 2021 in the Journal of Natural Food found that animal-based foods produce double the greenhouse gas emissions as plant-based ones, and meat ranked near the top of 57,000 foods in terms of environmental impact, according to the Oxford University researchers, who published their results in Environmental Sciences in August 2022. Raising edible bugs is significantly less of an impact on the environment than raising other livestock, the American Heart Association points out. Pound for pound, edible bugs produce significantly fewer greenhouse gases than meat, according to Time. When you take into consideration the negative effects of overfishing, as well as greenhouse gases, water, and other land usage that result from traditional farming, practicing edible bugs are definitely a sustainable alternative. Given all this information, I felt compelled to give bugs a try, but where to start? A quick internet search showed crickets are a popular choice and are available whole as flavored snacks, ground into powder, or even in ready-to-eat protein bars. I'm also familiar with mealworms because I feed them to my chickens as a way to increase the amount of protein in their diets. If it worked for them, I figure it could work for me too. I had seen an episode of one of my favorite travel and eating shows that was filmed in Mexico and featured tacos and fresh guacamole garnished with ants. I had to give it a try. If you're like me and interested in trying bugs, I cannot stress enough that you can find a supplier of food-grade edible insects. Do not forage for your own bugs, as you have no idea where your bugs have been. Bugs that are intended for human consumption are raised and prepared safely. You don't want any of those, risky taking bugs. And regarding safety, proceed with caution if you have food allergies. Many bugs are anthropophages, just like lobsters and shrimp. See, as a result, there seems to be a link between allergy to shellfish and bugs, according to one systematic reviewer. If you have food allergies, be sure to check with your doctor before eating bugs. Here are the results of my taste test. Crickets. Salty and crunchy, these guys are good if you can't get over the fact they're bugs. I can definitely see why these are popular. What they taste like. They're nutty and slightly smoky. Nutritional benefits. Protein, antioxidants, and fiber. How to enjoy them. As a crunchy snack, ground into baked goods, or in a protein bar. Interesting. Ants. My first impression. These were definitely not the most appealing at first glance. However, they tasted surprisingly wonderful. To be honest, these end up being my personal favorites. Their bright flavor makes them a perfect protein-packed topping that I can see. I can see why they're so many popular in so many other cultures. Bright and citrusy is what they taste like. Nutritional benefits, protein, iron, zinc, potassium. How to enjoy them. On guacamole, on tacos, on celery with peanut butter. Literally, ants on a log. Mealworms. Oh, wait. I got to go back. I lost the page. Yeah, mealworms. I don't know about this one. This is it. At first bite, I can definitely see easing these again. I picture them sprinkled on top of tacos or fried rice. I hate when things pop up on the page. Thank you. If you're up to giving bugs a try, mealworms seem like an approachable starter bug. Yeah. Nutty, salty, slightly sweet is what they taste like. And the nutritional benefits of all the other guys. That's really kind of interesting. I'd have to, I think I'd have to be, pushed into it. And when I say pushed into it, meaning that there were, no more goats, chickens, cows, anything of that nature. Any actual meat left, I would consider it. I would consider it. I would. Especially if I were stoned. I would. I got to be honest. And with the economy being what it is these days, Anyway, let me remove that. What do we got here? Speaking of Homeland Security workers charged with... Oh, this is good. This is out of the GOPtimes.com. Homeland Security workers charged with spying for China. And this is dated October 21 of this year. Department of Homeland Security agent and former agent have been criminally charged with an alleged CCP-based plan to spy on the critics of the Chinese government living within the U.S. 15-year employee of the Department of Homeland Security, Craig Miller, and former DHS worker, Derek Taylor, were alleged by prosecutors to have planned a scheme to steal information from a restricted federal law enforcement database. The two men are among the latest defendants indicted in a probe of what American officials have defined as increasingly aggressive efforts by the Chinese government to seek out, silence, and threaten pro-democracy activists abroad. Assistant Attorney General for National Security Matthew G. Olson said in a statement from the Department of Justice, "We will defend the rights of people in the United States to engage in free speech and political expression, including views of the PRC government, wants to silence. As charged, these individuals, agents of a foreign government in seeking to suppress dissenting voices, have taken refuge here. The defendant includes two sworn law enforcement officials who chose to be forsaken their oaths and violate the law. This indictment is the next step in holding all of these defendants responsible for their crimes." And according to the Department of Justice, there was a handful of other men that were also indicted in the case. all of whom supposedly carried out transitional repression scheme to target U.S. residents whose political views and actions are disfavored by the CCP. They include Fan Frank Liu and Matthew Zebras, arrested in March, as well as Quang Jason Sun, who still remains at large. The Daily Wire reported more details on the incident. According to Justice Department, according to relevant court documents, one of Liu's co-conspirators allegedly retained Taylor to obtain personal information about multiple PRC dissidents living in the United States, including flight records, passport information, and photographs. Taylor was allegedly assisted by two other DHS officers, including Miller. These contacts within the DHS allegedly obtained the information from a restricted government database and illicitly provided it to Taylor. Liu, Zebras, and Sun allegedly used this information to target and harass these dissidents on behalf of the PRC. Miller allegedly deleted text messages between himself and Taylor while being questioned by authorities, and Taylor supposedly instructed an associate to withhold evidence from the FBI. Miller and Taylor have been charged with obstruction of justice, and Taylor has additionally been charged with making false statements to the FBI. Liu and Zebras are being charged with conspiracy to act as agents of the PRC. Liu, Zebras, and Sun are being, to commit interstate harassment and criminal use of means of identification. The accused, if convicted, face decades in prison with possible sentences for the defendants ranging between 20 and 30 years. Here's what a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington had to say. I'm not aware of this specific situation. I would like to stress in principle that the Chinese side always asks overseas Chinese citizens to comply with host country's laws and regulations. We firmly oppose these acts by the U.S. government that are groundless, malign, and smear China. And then 15 minutes later, he said the same thing. So interesting. Let's see. What do I got here? All right. This is vote stuff, I guess. I could have started arranging these in, like, folders. This is out of justthenews.com. And findings of nursing homes voter fraud spur conservative groups to join forces to protect seniors. Seniors are a vulnerable group most likely to be victimized, said former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell. Stunned by the revelations of nursing home voter abuse in Wisconsin, the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC, and the American Constitutional Rights Union, ACRU, are partnering to help protect senior citizens from voter fraud. This week, the ARCU launched its Center for Vulnerable Voters, which offers resources, information, and training to protect the most vulnerable voters in the U.S., according to the center's website. The new center is an expansion of the ARCU's Protect Elderly Votes project from 2020. The center's goal include training residential facility staff in how to protect the voting rights of their most vulnerable residents, and enabling vulnerable voting constituency to protect their vote and exercise their civic right to participate in the American election process. The ACRU. Also has a senior citizens vote bill of rights that has been used by many facilities across the country. In addition to a guide for citizens and family members who wish to protect the rights of vulnerable voters. The ACRU's vote fraud hotline is also available for relatives of people who are incapacitated to report a fraudulent vote in their family's member's name. The AMAC president, Rebecca Weber, told the John Solomon Reports podcast on Thursday that it's important for senior citizen organizations to get involved to protect our over 2 million AMAC members and every senior here in the country. Alveda King, niece of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., has joined the ARC in its efforts to expose and put an end to elderly voter fraud, particularly fraud found in nursing homes and other senior citizen facilities, Weber announced in a joint ACRU-AMAC press conference. Recalling that her uncle fought to ensure that every single American had the right to vote freely, the conservative activist lamented that many of the voters are nursing home residents who are often targeted by those who would steal or suppress their votes. The joint release highlights a town hall article by two ACR board members, former Attorney General Edwin Neese and former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, that supports the special counsel Gableman's findings on nursing homes voter fraud in Wisconsin as one of the flashing red signals that so much abuse is widespread. Gableman's report found that 91 nursing homes in the counties of Milwaukee, Racine, Dane, Kenosha, and Brown had voter turnouts ranging from 95 to 100 in 2020. Wisconsin State Rep. Mark Spretzer, ranking member of the Assembly Elections Committee, said Gableman's report should not have made an assertion about nursing home turnout based upon partial data and should have reached out to the actual experts, like the Wisconsin Elections Commission. That could have explained how this works. Instead, he released a report that was incorrect and deceptive. Due to election issues, such as the loose chain of custody of ballots and the inadequate verification system, seniors are the group most likely to be victimized, Blackwell told the news on Thursday. AMAC's involvement in this and its vast network of senior citizens engaged in the process is just unprecedented, he said. We've been working with election integrity networks across the country, and what's needed now is a full court press and as many volunteers as we can get to obtain to be election observers or workers, emphasized the former Cincinnati mayor. So that's a good thing, not for nothing. I don't know how they managed 100% turnout. That doesn't sound exactly right. And I guess we're still on, we'll stay on legal stuff, I guess. Did I hold this? Did I do this? All right, I don't want to do that one right now. Let's see. All right, this is for my friends in New York. Lee Zeldin inches past Kathy Hochul. And dead heat governor's race, stunning new polls reveal. This was dated as of yesterday. So Republican Representative Lee Zeldin has edged past Democratic incumbent Kathy Hochul by decimal points, and the race for governor is now a dead heat, a stunning new poll released Friday reveals. This was the Post, the New York Post. The independent coefficient study of 1,056 likely voters showed that Zeldin with a 4.56 support and Hochul at 5.3, with the rest undecided. The margin of error for the survey is minus or plus 3.3 points. Significantly, it's the first poll showing Zeldin, who has run a campaign focusing on law and order, amid a crime surge, running ahead of or even in a dead heat with the Democratic governor. A poll released by the same group in early September had Hochul leading Zeldin, the Long Island congressman, by 6 points. The race has been tightening over the last few weeks, and it appears that it is now in a dead heat. The shift has been led by predominantly white and Hispanic registered Democratic voters defecting to support Zeldin, the Republican candidate, coefficient pollster Ryan Muntz said. Republican Lee Zeldin has caught up. The race is now in a dead heat. With a little under 3 weeks to go, we expect to see measurable movement in the statewide electorate. And if the trend continues, New York could have its first Republican governor since 2006. That would be a very good thing for New York. The same right-leaning pollster predicted GOP underdog Glenn Youngkin's upset victory over Democratic Terry McAuliffe in the governor's, Virginia governor's race last year. Okay, so these people pretty much know what they're talking about. A finding at the poll was that Zeldin is beating Hochul by a handily among self-described independents and voters not yet registered with either party, which is really who you're going after anyway in any given election. A key block of swing voters, he needs to offset the enormous Democratic Party enrollment advantage. You know, all those dead people and whatnot. Zeldin said the latest poll showing him 0.3 point edge over Hochul proves he has momentum during the final stretch into the November 8th elections. The stakes couldn't be higher and the polls couldn't be closer. We need every single New Yorker who is sick and tired of attacks on our wallets, safety, and kids' education, and more to come out to vote and save our state, Zeldin said. So, yeah. What's this? Okay, yeah. This is our last chance to turn New York around by firing Kathy Hochul, electing new leadership to restore balance in Albany and secure our streets and put hardworking New Yorkers' families first, he said. Hochul campaign had no immediate comment. The latest findings provide that more evidence that the race for governor is a toss-up. So that's good news. That's actually very good news. She wasn't even, I don't believe, yeah, she was appointed after, what's his face left, right? I forget what position she held that she was, she became, I don't know how that works in New York. She was lieutenant governor, or she was some sort of something. We had the same thing happen here because our governor became, I think she's in either commerce or transportation czar. They don't use the word czar. What do they call that? What's that term? Secretary of Commerce or Secretary of Transportation. I forget which one. But our governor here, Gina Raimondo, was called the Washington. And see, that's the only way to get rid of like not so great politicians in Rhode Island. They send them to Washington, which makes no sense. It really doesn't in the long run. I just don't get it. I keep threatening to do a show on Rhode Island politics. And I think one of these days, maybe before I get out of here, while it's still relevant, I'll do that. Let's see. This is good. This is out of the Daily Mail. Judge grants deposition of Fauci, Jen Psaki, and other high-ranking Biden officials in case over collusive relationship between administration and social media companies to censor free speech. A federal judge has ordered Dr. Anthony Fauci and a slew of other high-ranking Biden officials to be deposed over the government's alleged collusion with social media companies to censor free speech. On Friday, the court granted the request by Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt and Louisiana Attorney General Jeff Landry, both Republicans, both accused the Biden administration of having worked hand-in-hand with social media giants to censor news stories that reflected negatively upon the White House and called it an egregious attack on our First Amendment, a report said. The suit alleges that the Biden administration actively worked with social media companies and encouraged them to censor disfavored viewpoints and speakers in violation of the First Amendment rights of those individuals. In his decision, the U.S. Attorney General Terry Daugherty asserted that Fauci's prior public comments in relation to the national pandemic policy made him a relevant figure in the case and ordered his deposition. The American people deserve an answer on how the federal government has colluded with social media companies to censor free speech, Schmidt said. Other high-ranking officials who must sit for depositions include Jen Psaki, the former White House press secretary, director of White House digital strategy, Rob Flaherty, or former White House senator for COVID-19 advisory, Andrew Slavitt, the FBI supervisory special agent, Elvis Chang. Oh, that's a cool name. Elvis Chan, excuse me. CIS director, Jen Easterly, or CISA official, Lauren Protonis, Surgeon General Victor Murthy, CDC Chief of Digital Media Branch Carol Crawford, and Acting Coordinator of State Department's Global Engagement Center Danielle Kimmage, are also deposed. Wow, that is a lot of people. Throughout this case, we have uncovered disturbing amount of collusion between big tech and big government, Landry said in a statement on Monday. The 164-page lawsuit was filed last week, but an updated Monday filing indicates that the Republican officials are widening their legal efforts to target 47 more government departments, agencies, and offices, and officials, in addition to the 20 defendants originally listed. President Joe Biden and current Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre and Nina Jankowicz, who was meant to head Biden's now defunct Disinformation Governance Board, are among the dozens defendants listed in the suit. Lastly, plaintiffs argue that Dr. Fauci's credibility has been in question on matters related to supposed COVID-19 misinformation since 2020. Specifically, the plaintiff said that Dr. Fauci has made public statements on the efficiency of masks, the percentile of population needed for herd immunity, NIAID's funding of the gain-of-function virus research in Wuhan, the lab link theory, and more, he wrote. Plaintiffs argue that his comments on these important issues are relevant to the matter at hand and are further reasons why Dr. Fauci should be deposed. Plaintiffs assert that they should not be required to simply accept Dr. Fauci's self-serving blanket denials that were issued from someone other than himself at face value. The court agrees, he continued. Doherty, who was appointed by Donald Trump, cast aside the Justice Department's attempt to use executive privilege, claiming that it would only apply to internal administration emails. Emails with outside executives were fair game, he ruled. Their correspondence also obviously relevant to the case, the judge wrote, and their correspondences are also obviously very relevant to the case, the judge wrote in his 10-page opinion. Dr. Fauci's communication would be relevant to plaintiffs' allegations in reference to the alleged suppression of speech relating to the lab leak theory of the COVID-19's origin, and to the alleged suppression of speech about the efficiency of mass and COVID-19 lockdowns, court filings stated. Jean-Pierre's communications as White House press secretary could be relevant to all plaintiffs' examples. Wow. So this is really kind of interesting. If I could get rid of this thing in the middle of my screen, I would definitely, I got an issue here, and I don't know what it is. Because there's some examples here. Okay. See, why is it doing this? I don't know why it's doing this. Hang on. Oi. All right. Maybe if I did that. Nope. Well, let's see. I can't get it to do what I want it to do. Yeah, I don't know why they do that. Super fucking annoying. Okay. So, that's it. That's the end of that. What do we got here? Under pressure from... this is interesting. Speaking of crime in New York City, this is an article again from the Daily Mail in regards to under pressure, New York City Mayor Eric Adams tells residents to put their phones away and stop using Apple AirPods, suggesting unaware subway riders may be the reason for the rising crime. Yeah, okay. The mayor of New York City has recommended subway passengers stop using their phones or headphones while they're on increasingly dangerous transit system to avoid falling victim to soaring crime. Transit crime in the America's largest city is up 41% year on year. Wow. With 8 people murdered on the subway so far this year. Holy smokes. By contrast, in 2019, there are only 3 subway murders, one in 2018 and none in 2017. Eric Adams, under increasing pressure to take decisive action and make the subway safer on Friday, was asked for his advice. Adams said that there's been a 40% increase in crime on the subway service. The Fox News anchor Bianca Peters told Adams, "I haven't put my AirPods in over a year because I feel like I need to be very much aware." Adams replied, "Well, first, I think that you're right about that. You know, not having the AirPods and not focusing on the phone. And I say yes to that. I do the same. We put out a video and information telling people to be aware of what's going on around them, which is you always need to do in New York anyway, so it doesn't really. Yeah, what's around them and what's taking place. I encourage New Yorkers to do that. Yeah, they kind of teach us that out of the cradle, not for nothing. In January, Adams said he felt unsafe riding the subway. Okay, so when the mayor says he feels unsafe riding the subway, it's pretty much done. Stick a fork in it. On Friday, he said the common denominator in all instances is mental health is the mental health crisis on the streets. Right, because they're dumping, you know, because it's a homeless crazy problem, or the crazy homeless people problem, I guess. Where are we? A combination. Okay, yeah. It's a combination of ensuring that we deal with the actual violence, but also people must feel safe in the city of New York City, he said. Wow, he's brilliant. At 3.5 million people use our subway system every day. We have an average of 5 felony crimes on the system per day. But you're seeing all this disorder and people with mental health issues and people with the shooters you're reading about, blah, blah, blah. You may begin not to feel unsafe, but you're seeing some of the violence. So that's why we have to go about it both ways. This guy doesn't even speak English. That's why we're moving in both directions. And guns, guns, guns. That's what's driving this problem. Wow. Earlier this week, Queensman Herberto Quinonta, 48, died after falling onto the tracks and was being struck by a train in Jackson Heights. The fall was as a result of an argument and a shoving match that ensued when he bumped into Carlos Garcia, 50, on the platform, causing him to drop his cell phone. Garcia then demanded Quinto go get his phone, and when he refused, the two began arguing in Spanish, and a shoving fight ensued, causing Quinonta to be pushed onto the tracks into an oncoming train. Garcia was arrested on Tuesday and charged with manslaughter. Wow. Yeah, but there's plenty of, there's like, every now and then you get just like outright crazy people pushing someone. I'm going to get a drink. Pushing someone onto the tracks. So, I mean, it's not, it is somewhat of a mental health issue, but it's not in its entirety. You can't point it off on that hand. In my view, things have been, since the riots that occurred during the Floyd uprisings, particularly in New York, I think the criminal element has felt more emboldened that they won't be pursued by police and that they can get away with more things. They found that out when they tore New York City apart last time. And I think that's the God honest truth about that. That's my own narrative there. At the time, he was trying to intervene when Alvin Charles started harassing a female NYPD police officer. During an argument between the pair, Charles pulled out a knife and stabbed the 43-year-old steam lifter in the neck. Nice. Police arrested Charles, who had previously faced assault charges for stabbing another man last year. Why was he on the streets? Why was he on the streets? He has been walking free ever since being allowed on bail. A judge denied him that he would be held on $50,000 bail. Bailey's death is just one of the many strings of senseless murders on the subway, three of which occurred in the first 3 weeks of October. Last week, 15-year-old Jajon Burnett was shot dead by a known gang member on a Far Rockaway A train just days before his 16th birthday. Kendra Russell, 18, was charged with Burnett's murder in his second degree and two counts of criminal possession of a weapon. Assistant District Attorney Christine Okugrasel called the murder a gang-related incident. Charles Moore, 38, and a father were stabbed in the back and chest after leaving a northbound 4 train on the Bronx on 10:30 on October 6th. Seagon Lemons, 27, was arrested for allegedly stabbing Moore. The attack was random and unprovoked, according to police. Yeah, okay, so it goes on. Oh, hey, we got some more stuff. Marcus Bretta, 24, was shot and killed at Jamaica Center subway station in April while working as a subway card swiper. Danielle Enriquez, 48, was riding a Q train that was headed over the Manhattan Bridge when a gunman opened fire without warning on May 22nd. The Goldman Sachs employee never took the subway, his partner Adam Patrick told of Daily Com at the time, but had an Uber to and from Williamsburg that would have cost him $80. Andrew Abdullah, 25, was arrested in that attack. Another subway brawl located at 137th Street City College train station on June left a 14-year-old dead from a stab wound to the stomach. Police recovered a knife and a broomstick thought to have been involved in the crime. Michelle Alicio, Go, 49, was killed January 15th when she was shoved onto the subway tracks of a southbound NQRW platform at West 42nd Street and Broadway at around 9:40 a.m. in an unprovoked attack. Simon Marshall, 61, was arrested and charged with Go's death a day later. He was sent to a psychiatric facility after prosecutors declined to challenge a mental evaluation that found him unfit to stand trial. On New Year's Day, Roland Houston was killed after jumping onto the tracks to rescue a man who had been attacked by a group of knife-wielding thugs. Two boys, 16 and 17, were arrested for murder and gang assault a week later. Miguel Rodriguez frog marched out of a police station and into a police car Monday, days after striking and shoving Germando Sabato, 26, into a part of a northbound 6 train on the East 149th Street station Saturday morning. Terrifying clip of the attack shows the suspect, who cops say is Ramirez, appeared wild-eyed and unhinged moments before the shove took place. Charges pending against Ramirez, while Sabio, was rescued by a Good Samaritan, suffered leg injuries. I mean, it's just an absolute mess. And tied directly into that, let me see if I can find it. No, it's not there. I wonder what I did with it. I thought I had a story that had, that mentioned, no, I guess I don't. No, I guess I don't. I thought I had a story on, I did. I just lost it. I don't know, they got like 1,400 police officers retiring going into the end of the year. These are officers who, again, we go back to the riots. I don't think that the police officers in the police officers union had any reason to believe that they were being supported by their local politicians, but local even up to the mayor. As a matter of fact, I think they were obviously being held back. They were being told to hold back while crimes were being committed, and they just let it go because that's what they were told to do, and they did it. And now they don't feel that they're supported at all. They feel, you know, there's this big and I guess it's still to some degree having some ripple effects. Some places have figured out that maybe it's not the best thing in the world to do, but there's still a lot of fallout from the defund the police movement. I know if I were a police officer, that would be certainly demoralizing to me. And if I were close to retirement age or getting there, and maybe I want to get out of there as soon as I can. I mean, why bother be a police officer in a city that isn't going to support you when you have to do your job? So I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. And who knows? Maybe it's the end for New York. Maybe it's the end. Let's see. And this is out of Revolver. This is the last one I'll do, honestly. This is out of Revolver. Travesty of justice. Abandoned sentence to 4 months hard prison time for defying disgrace January 6th committee. Former Trump chief strategist and host of the media juggernaut War Room Pandemic, Steve Bannon, has been sentenced to 4 months in prison and a $6,500 fine for contempt of Congress. Bannon, this is out of Fox. Bannon was found guilty of contempt of Congress in July after he ignored a subpoena from the House January 6th committee. Bannon was released pending appeal, and if an appeal is not made, Bannon must surrender voluntarily by November 15th, U.S. District Attorney Carl Nichols ruled. District Judge, excuse me. The Justice Department had recommended a six-month prison sentence and a $200,000 fine for the former Trump aide, Steve Bannon, due to his failure to comply with the subpoena to appear before the House Select Committee investigating January 6th. I want to thank all you guys for coming, Bannon said, entering the courthouse Friday. Remember, this illegitimate regime, their judgment day is on 8 November when the Biden administration ends. I want to thank all of you for coming. the four month sentences for Bannon's refusal to comply with the subpoena issued to him from corrupt January 6th committee, from the corrupt January 6th committee. Revolver has extensively covered the conflicts of interest and corruption that beleaguers the disgraced and publicized January 6th committee. I covered some of that last week, if you recall. I covered a lot of it last week, if you recall. Ever the determined and happy warrior, a defiant Bannon had a strong message for the illegitimate regime that has taken to prosecuting its political opponents. Okay. So, yeah. That is that. And it's 12:56, but I do want to play a tune on the way out. Right? I'm going to play Hell in a Bucket. Because that works. It's appropriate. It works. Anyway, let me see. If you want to head over to, what is this? What's this over here? Yeah, lfmidwood.com. Head over to lfmidwood.com at the home, the only home, the internet home of the Midwood Files. And up there you'll find my archives with cute little blurbs. It's all searchable. If you head to archives, see the little radio button, and you click that, and you go all the way down to 05, or no, 2016. I think it's going to be 6 years. I guess next week's show will basically be 6 years. So, yeah. I like them apples. 6 fucking years. Anyway, who'd have thunk it? Anyway, you'll also find my social media up here, and you'll find my favorites, which I often use to compose the news section of the program. I think Dave's on tomorrow. I think I'm starting to get this a little bit better. So if you're listening to this tomorrow morning, know that Dave is on, Dave the Boogeyman is on live on the 11 hour night streams on Sunday night, starting, I guess he does a pregame as well too. I don't understand, but anyway, he'll be there with lots of music you need to hear. I really tried. Anyway, that being said, I hope that you all come back next week. Where I'm going to go for 5 in a row. Yes, 5 shows in a row. Yes, count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We may have the count from Sesame Street come in just to do that for us, but I don't know. He's under contract. Maybe a little difficult. Anyway, I'm going to play Hell in a Bucket, and then I'm getting out of here. I thank you all for imbibing, and I will catch you next week. Bye, y'all.
Chopper up and down your carpeted halls. You'll think me by contrast quite proper. Never mind, I stumble and fall. Never mind, I stumble and fall. You imagine me sipping champagne from your blue for a taste of your elegant part. I may be going to hell in a bucket, babe, but at least I'm enjoying the ride. I'm enjoying the ride. tribute, champagne from your booth, where I taste of your elegant pride.
Been listening to the Midwood Files on Radio New York International. Thanks for listening.